It's 7:30 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Beth Voorhees. Photographer Builder Levy returned to take pictures of the coal fields after he did so in the 1960s.
If you look at my book and my photographs, I'm hoping you'll just have a greater appreciation of Appalachia and of America.
The story coming up on this West Virginia morning. After scandals surrounding the use of federal and state money to purchase routers and build emergency communications towers across West Virginia, the legislature is taking a closer look at how the state is handling those types of funds in a variety of aspects. Some lawmakers are focused on reforming the state's purchasing procedures, and others on auditing the projects. Meanwhile, a technology committee is focused on major government spending to expand broadband access to rural communities. As Ashton Mara reports, one internet company's CEO claims the project didn't accomplish that goal.
The terms router gate and tower gate have been thrown around in committee meetings, in newspaper articles, on social media, to refer to what some are calling major mess-ups by the previous and current administration's efforts to expand internet access across the state. The funds those scandals misused came to West Virginia as a grant under the Federal Broadband Technology Opportunities Program, known as BTOP for short. Legislative audits show that money was misused in various ways, and now some are calling on the state to take a look at whether the expansion of the state's broadband fiber optic cable network has also been mismanaged.
You know, we've already had a router gate, we had a tower gate, you know, we don't need a fiber gate.
President and CEO of internet provider CityNet, Jim Martin, speaking during an interim committee on technology meeting, referred to the fiber expansion program headed by Frontier Communications. As a part of the grant award, the state identified about 1,000 so-called anchor locations, places like schools, public libraries, or prisons. An anchor location would receive a new router. Yes, those same router gate routers, and would then be hooked up with new cable to the existing broadband network in their area by Frontier Communications. The grant says that cable is then open access, meaning any company could connect. In theory, rural communities would be gaining access not only to broadband, but also to competition on the market. But Martin says that's not what happened.
In Bridgeport, at the public library, Frontier did not have fiber going into the library. It was out on the street, but it didn't go into the library. So what they did is they built 1,000 foot of fiber from the data room of the library out to the pole, and then they connected it into their network at that point.
Martin says that 1,000 feet of cable from the library to the pole is open access for his company, CityNet, to provide service. But it's such a small portion of cable, it's unusable. Martin says instead, Frontier should have run the cable from the individual community anchors to a centralized location where all communication wires from all providers come together. That way, the providers would have had access to the federally funded fibers. But that's where the grant stipulations come into play. Gail Given, the state's chief technology officer, who also happens to be a former Frontier executive, says the grant was written to leverage the existing infrastructure, meaning the company couldn't duplicate existing Frontier fibers.
So if there was no fiber, then we ran fiber from the central office all the way to the school or whatever. If there was fiber halfway to the school, then we picked up there and went the rest of the way.
Martin, however, maintains that cable should have been duplicated, giving other providers open access to the area and creating competition in rural communities.
Charleston's already got competition, Bridgeport does, but it's out in those towns like Pickens or Helvetia because there's only one provider there, and probably that network that they've got is old and antiquated. So BTOP was about building long distance fiber cables from your larger markets into those very rural markets, and then make that cable available to anybody. And then that effectively will create competition.
Meaning better prices, better service, better broadband for you, the customer. Committee members also brought up concerns about the cost of the expansion. The state essentially spent $42 million on 675,000 miles of cable and building costs. That's an average of about $57,000 per mile. Given says that's about 22% higher than expected, but Martin believes the state paid more than they should have. Martin says his company and other providers estimate it should have cost $30,000 per mile, but Given disagreed. In a previous interim meeting, officials from Frontier attributed the additional cost to legal fees and the requirement to pay prevailing wage on state projects. Chairman Mike Green says no legislation will come from the Technology Committee this interim session. He calls the discussion on the broadband expansion project fact-finding and says committee members will assist the Senate President, House Speaker, Governor, and members of the Legislative Auditor's Office on future recommendations when it comes to grant implementation and purchasing. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara in Charleston.
This is West Virginia Morning. It's coming up on 7:36. Schools in Mineral County had been on a two-hour delay, but schools in Mineral County have now announced that they are closed for today. The National Weather Service has issued a winter weather advisory until 5 o'clock this afternoon for nearly the entire state. Between 1 and 4 inches of snow are possible in the lower elevations, up to 6 inches in the higher elevations. It'll be windy with gusts of up to 35 miles per hour and daytime highs in the 20s and 30s. Becoming mostly clear tonight, blustery and cold with lows in the teens, and windy with gusts of up to 45 miles per hour overnight. Sunshine, but continued cold on Wednesday with temperatures in the 20s and 30s.
Support provided by the West Virginia Division of Rehabilitation Services, enabling and empowering workers with disabilities to meet business workforce needs. Visit WVDRS.org for employer services.
About 40 years ago, a New York photographer named Builder Levy ventured to Appalachia to document life in the coal fields. As Levy traveled the region and got to know its people, he came to love and admire the place. Through a commission from the Appalachian College Association, Levy was able to return between 2002 and 2009 to document the changes that have taken place since he first visited in the late 1960s. The result is a book of photographs and narrative, Appalachia, USA, which tells the story of how the coal fields have changed. Levy recently talked with Cecilia Mason about the experience reflected in his newest book.
What is it about this particular region that attracted you?
You have one of the most beautiful regions in the United States. Your beautiful Appalachian mountains, and especially in central Appalachia, where the mountains are stark and steep, and the most biodiverse region of North America. And at the same time, you have a highly industrialized area, or at the time when I started, through the coal miners. So it's rural, it's industrial, and you have a fantastic heritage of Appalachia, and I knew something about it, and it grew on me.
Do you keep in touch with the people that we're looking at in the book?
Well, I had gone back and visited this guy, Charlie Blevins, who ran the Red Robin Inn, and that's in my social landscape, a picture of a wall on his Red Robin Inn. And so I visited him again after more than 30 years later, and it was just a month and a half after I visited him, he died of lung complications, and he had black lung when I visited him. He was on a oxygen tank a lot of the time, but he stopped and played one of his banjos and sang a couple of old-time mountain songs for me. So then, in order to get more of his story, I was able to talk with his daughter by phone, and she was so helpful in giving me more of his early life and family life so that I could put it in this book.
There was one person, Toby Moore. He seemed interesting.
Toby Moore, that's a fascinating story. thank you for asking about him. You see, Toby Moore was the first underground portrait miner that I made a photograph of. It was back in Eastern Coal Company. It was a subsidiary of the large company Pittston. And I had followed some other miners with their permission one morning from Williamson, West Virginia, into their over the bridge into Kentucky to get to that mine. And I had no special introduction, no permission. And I just started photographing a little bit on the mine site while miners were waiting for their shift change. One of the foremen, who had become friendly with me, said, "How would you like to go inside?" Of course, I wanted to all the time. Hadn't even gotten around to asking, "Can I go in?" And so I said, "Yeah, I'd love to, but I didn't bring a flash." He said, "Okay, we'll provide the lights for you." So one Saturday morning, a few days after that conversation, I was inside their mine, the old House Branch mine, and this guy, I didn't know his name, this black miner came by. I asked him, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm on my lunch break." And I said, "Could I take your portrait?" He said, "Okay." And I was able to make this guy's portrait.
Why do you think Toby Moore captures people's attention?
It's unadulterated real. I'm looking at the portrait again, and there were other things that I like about it. It's a very rich photograph, and it at the same time speaks of an intense life. And that, in effect, is maybe what I'm trying to say, or what I see and I saw in Central Appalachian coal fields of the United States. And maybe it is what I feel about America. Can Toby Moore and can this work be a metaphor for America?
One of the things that struck me about your book from the standpoint of an Appalachian is that it reflects a cultural diversity in this region that a lot of people from the outside just wouldn't see or document.
Yes. Well, that's one of the things that I wanted to go beyond and get past all kinds of stereotypes and get beyond romanticizing or denigrating. I wanted to avoid those pitfalls. And as a photographer artist, it's easy to fall into those things, either romanticizing, glorifying, or on the other hand, denigrating or looking down or being condescending. And you can do that without even thinking about it if you're not aware of it.
What do you hope people gain from going through the book, perusing the photographs, reading the information you have in it?
Well, I hope they gain a greater understanding of coalfield at Appalachia, Central Appalachia, understanding that it's an important part of American heritage. The meaning of America, you can find it right there in Central Appalachia. The beauty, the heartbreak, and the love, and the desecration, and the intense humanity, and yes, some inhumanity also. So I think that if you look at my book and my photographs, I'm hoping you'll just have a greater appreciation of Appalachia and of America.
Well, Builder Levy, I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
Well, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity.
Builder Levy's book, Appalachia, USA, is published by David R. Goodine Publisher. Some school systems that had been on a two-hour delay are now closed. Schools in Boone, Brook, Kanawha, Putnam, and Summers counties are now closed. We'll have a complete list for you in just a few moments. Grammy nominations were announced over the weekend, and among those nominated is West Virginia native Tim O'Brien. He and Daryl Scott are nominated for Best American Roots Song for Keep Your Dirty Lights On. O'Brien was also recently inducted into the West Virginia Music Hall of Fame. In this excerpt from the induction ceremony, we hear about O'Brien's life and work, narrated by the host of Mountain Stage, Larry Gross.
He said, I got horses, I got mules, I got sheep. Some I want to sell, boys, and some I want to keep.
Wheeling native Tim O'Brien has been called a master of American folk music by none other than Mark Knopfler. While that description is true, it only hints at O'Brien's rich, diverse, and still evolving career. Respected and admired in bluegrass, folk, country, and Americana, Tim has long been a regular on the festival circuit, from North Carolina's Merlefest to San Francisco's Hardly Strictly Bluegrass. He's known for his singing, songwriting, and production skills, and is a threat on guitar, mandolin, fiddle, bouzouki, and banjo. Born in 1954 to parents Frank and Amy O'Brien, Tim was inspired by Bob Dylan and the Beatles and immersed himself in country and bluegrass music he heard on WWVA's Jamboree USA, starting on guitar at age 12. After high school at Lindsley Military Institute and a year at Maine's Colby College, he started playing music professionally. Landing in Boulder, Colorado in 1974, he made his first recordings with the Ophelia Swing Band, and in 1978, co-founded the bluegrass band Hot Rise. Along with the comedic alter ego Red Knuckles and the Trailblazers, Hot Rise toured the world, earning him an international reputation for his mandolin and fiddle playing, clear tenor singing, and songwriting. Nellie Kane, one of his first compositions, has since become a bluegrass music standard. In the late 1980s, Bluegrass's Newgrass Revival and The Seldom Seen recorded his songs, and fellow West Virginian Kathy Mattea scored top 10 country hits with Walk the Way the Wind Blows and Untold Stories. Kathy and Tim's duet, The Battle Hymn of Love, soon went to number 9 on the Billboard charts. The 90s brought covers by country artists Garth Brooks and the Dixie Chicks. Tim has released more than 20 CDs. Included among these are collaborations with his sister Molly, old-time music guru Dirk Powell, and songwriter Daryl Scott. O'Brien and Scott's Real Time is considered a classic. His Bob Dylan tribute, Red on Blonde, earned a 1997 Grammy nomination, while 1999's The Crossing told the story of his Irish ancestors' immigration to North America. He also played a major role in the West Virginia Music Hall of Fame's 2007 tribute CD to Blind Alfred Reed, Always Lift Him Up. And in 2012, Tim and Molly's family band released a tribute to Roger Miller called Reincarnation. His International Bluegrass Music Association awards include Entertainer of the Year with Hot Rise in 1990, Male Vocalist of the Year in 1993 and 2006, and Song of the Year in 2006. His folk CD, Fiddler's Green, won a Grammy in 2005. These awards raised O'Brien's profile and made him an in-demand session player and producer. Tim has recorded and performed with Ralph Stanley, The Chieftains, Steve Earle, Mark Knopfler, and Steve Martin. He's performed on the Grand Ole Opry, Austin City Limits, A Prairie Home Companion, and on a recent PBS tribute to Woody Guthrie. And he's been a guest on Mountain Stage more than any other artist. He's toured throughout the USA, Canada, Europe, Japan, and Australia. Tim's involvement in roots music is tireless and enthusiastic. He is always on the lookout for music that catches his ear, whether it be Library of Congress field recordings or Japanese duo Humbert Humbert. But West Virginia and its music remain first and foremost in his heart. He served on the board of the West Virginia Music Hall of Fame since it was founded and played an active role in all of its projects. He is a native son that should make us all proud.
And Tim O'Brien has another Grammy nomination for Best American Roots Song this year. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Keep up with all the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Find stories, photos, and videos, and you can subscribe to our West Virginia Morning podcast. We're interested in your comments. You can send them to feedback at wvpublic.org. www.shepherdfolk.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Beneduccio. Our director is Bob Powell. I'm Beth Voorhees.